subjects. Pick a rant subject. Since you weren't involved in any of this.
Oh, I'm tempted to try and take these 3 points and draw a line between them. And you know, we have here the bazaar that's spelled with 3 A's, not an I. The open source model personified in Eric Raymond. We have here the foundation of gaming in regards. Phil Jackson is one of the biggest names in that business, and sitting in the middle, who the hell am I? If I see far, it's because, you know, the giants have sat far enough apart that I can see between them. I draw a webcomic. If I were to try and draw a straight line between that, I'd say that this model for creating things applies to some of the work that Steve does and some of the work that I do, and all the work that I do, and the universe is changing.
Open source study games lately, Steve?
Mm-hmm. Card games.
Cool.
They're playing that tomorrow, aren't they?
No, it's mentioned in the program book for no good reason.
By the way, have you played Pilot Cove?
Yes.
It's the latest game from Days of Wonder, and it's pretty cool.
Wait, is that the Tropico 2 that you're talking about? Okay.
No.
Okay.
No, this is from Days of Wonder, the people who did
the rival cards and
okay.
You build
okay. Okay. Yeah. A board
no,
game.
No, it's different. No, this is a board game. And it's got the Days of Wonder trademark feel. Bright graphics, a lot of nice back sort of color in the game. Plays really fast. You are pirate captains. You are competing to loot treasure and carry it to an island where you can bury it. But you have problems. You're being hunted by legendary pirates like Blackbeard and those two, and Bonnie and whoever else, and the British Navy and so forth. So sometimes you have to fight other pirates, sometimes you have to loot treasure. It's like Ticket to Ride Europe in that you've always got several different alternative tactical lines in front of you, and you have to make careful trade-offs about which ones to pursue at any given moment. Anyway, I probably shouldn't rant about gaming for the rest of the hour, but it's a pretty good game. It is. As the conversation stalls out with a grinding crunch.
I tried to draw a line.
There's a whole spider web of lines. Do you have any desire to make that a game idea? If you wish to keep it under wraps. He hit me with a game proposal yesterday.
I don't know how to pitch games. I don't know how to pitch games, I don't know how to describe games, and this was probably illustrated in my pitch. But when you talk about a spider web of connections, Steve and I met because Steve, how did you get introduced to reading Schlock Mercenary?
I don't even recall. I don't know what the connection was. Somebody said, look at this, and I did.
And well, anyway, I realized one day that Steve Jackson was reading Schlock Mercenary and had mentioned me in a newsletter or something, and I got email, and Steve and I swapped email. One thing led to another, and now Steve Jackson Games is the merchandising arm for Schlock Mercenary, and that's where the T-shirt came from. So we have a business relationship, and the outgrowth of that was, boy, I had a friend with this game idea, and if I set the game in my fictional universe, and then I pitch it to Steve, maybe we'll all get rich. And the reason to pitch it to Steve is that I don't know the first thing about games. I'm not going to try and take this idea all the way to completion. I'm going to run it past him and see if it flies. Right now it's kind of a turkey.
Has it even got feathers?
Oh. We haven't settled all the components. That might be
right. Ah, okay.
Something that Howard doesn't specifically mention is that he is not doing a webcomic just for fun. Howard is one of the small number of people who is doing a webcomic to make a living, and as you see, he is still living.
Oh my God, I just had a frightening thought.
GURPS Schlock Mercenary.
Explain that one, please.
Oh, one of the things Steve's company publishes is GURPS, Generic Universal Role-Playing System.
Oh.
And they sell these books where you can plug GURPS rules into lots of different fictional universes. And they do a damn good job, too, by the way.
Okay.
So good that there are a substantial number of people like me who buy the books because they're fun to read, even though we don't play the system.
We have talked about the GURPS thing on Flock, and we want these guys.
There is. Have any of you familiar with GURPS? Show of hands, who's familiar with GURPS? Okay. Show of hands, who's familiar with Terry Pratchett? Okay. Terry Pratchett, there is a GURPS module for Discworld.
Yes.
Okay, GURPS Discworld. Actually, a couple of books, aren't there?
Yeah, we did a sequel.
Okay. The difference between GURPS Discworld and GURPS Schlock Mercenary is principally that Terry Pratchett already has a solid revenue stream from books in print. Okay? I don't. And I need to solve that problem before I spend any time writing a role-playing game. And Steve and I have had that conversation. Priority one for our relationship is getting a Schlock Mercenary Dead Tree Edition out the door. So
we had a long talk about that yesterday. We talked about the theoretical rates. We're going to shoot for a release at San Diego Comic-Con.
Which is when?
July 20th is coming out.
To help you understand what goes into something like this, the actual physical production process is about a three-month window because there's shipping and printing and whatever else. Prior to that, there's an editorial time period, and prior to that, there's 3 months in which Howard needs to get off his butt, draw some bonus material, write some more footnotes, and I just have to generate more content. And so don't blame Steve Jackson Games if the book is late, because my bit comes first.
That reminds me, this is not a game pitch, it's something that might turn into a game pitch someday. You remember back around 1990 when I talked about running a diplomacy mediation system I was working on.
Mm-hmm.
That never deployed. The reason it never deployed was that the right technology to support it didn't actually exist. I was trying something that the networking of the period and the programming languages of the period were not adequate to do. However, it is now 15 years later, and instead of having to code it in C that is chronically subject to memory allocation problems, I can write it in Python. And that's what I've been doing for the last 2 weeks, is translating it into Python and turning it into a web CGI-based interface. Now, though that concept might come back,
the next question is, of course, whether it can be genericized enough to make it morally appropriate enough to pay out for a month.
You
could probably make it legally appropriate.
In fact, I can say something useful about that, because my plan was never just in diplomacy.
Right.
I wanted to be able to specify the entire class of strategic games of which diplomacy is sort of one point in design space. So in my game spec language, you can say things like, see, I'd like to play on a Middle Earth map, I'd like to use panzers and zeppelins and the leader and spy rules. Okay? And you put that request in the system, and then anybody else who wants to play that game joins that request, and when it fills, and not before it fills, you get a notification that says, your game is active. So one of the games you can play in this system is Isomorphic to Diplomacy, but there are, I computed it once, there are approximately 22 million games that aren't. And every time I add another map or another variant or another unit type, the number explodes again.
Well, I would like to ask you devil's advocate question. Is the basic engine still diplomacy?
I'm going to sound like Bill Clinton for a moment. Say that depends on your definition of is. What do you mean by that question?
Well, the format of is each. Well, okay. We know the map is divided into discrete spaces.
That's right. It's an irregular terrain map.
Right. But is there one unit per space?
No. Okay. No. The engine has provision for stacking multiple units with different combat stress.
Okay. that makes it a whole lot less like diplomacy already.
Well, that's it. Risk. Actually, you could easily simulate risk using this engine.
I'm not suggesting that you're in violation of a trademark, but if you've got something that's going to build 22 million games, one of them is going to be risk. Right?
Yeah, actually, the fundamental premise here is I've noticed that there's a lot of online mediated gaming going on, but almost all of it has the property that you have to play in real time. If you're not prepared to spend 20 to 30 hours a week on it, you can't be competitive. So the reason I'm reviving this code is because it brings back the idea that you can play at basically at a tempo that you set.
That's gaming for busy people.
I want to play a game this month, and I don't want to play it all month.
Exactly.
I'm in complete agreement with that, but at this con last year, I talked about a deal that I had just made to take over a computer game called UltraCore, which was a science fiction exploration and combat game that played nominally at one turn a day.
Uh-huh.
It was for thousands of players.
Yeah.
And you entered your turn stuff, and you wait until the tick, which is when it looks at what everybody did, and you know, much like diplomacy, the success of what you ordered depends on what your neighbors did.
That feature has remained the case in my answer.
Yeah, because if you have simultaneous movement, you should have simultaneous revenue.
Yes, it's a simultaneous movement, simultaneous revenue.
Diplomacy did not invent simultaneous movement. But I had hoped to have that fixed and rolled out before then, but long story short, it turned out that the code that I had bought was absolutely dependent on a Microsoft environment, on an expensive one license per server Microsoft environment, on an obsolete, et cetera, Microsoft environment.
Oh, Eric, wait, his ears are bleeding. Just stop.
No, this is fun. And furthermore, although it was
for the record, Steve likes making my ears bleed.
Yeah, he does. You'll be able to make his ears bleed with the story of dinner later.
Yeah. Although it was spec'd to run several games at a time on the server, in fact, you had little issues when you tried to do that. So, we threw up our hands and started re-implementing the code. That re-implementation is this close to ready for alpha. It's not impossible that my coder came back from Serenity this afternoon and finished. I'll find out when I log on.
So how many people in here are programmers? Okay, so there are enough of you that I should say a paragraph about why the first attempt at this didn't work. It's because I wanted to do a game in which you had a whole bunch of people basically doing client stuff to a central database. The problem is, I designed this in 1985, when daemons that could handle multiple clients over sockets only existed one place, Berkeley, and it only existed for about a year. As a result, I had to try to do this as a bunch of client programs, each of which was running a terminal session to the user, like a character cell terminal session, and were communicating with each other by scribbling on areas in a common scratchpad file.
You're making my ears bleed.
And it turned out I wasn't clever enough to make this work. Now, in my defense, I will point out that it is likely the case that nobody is clever enough to make that work.
Three sets of polyethylene earmuffs, please.
I was a project manager, a product manager at Novell for several years, and I remember listening to my engineers talk about what they liked to describe as non-trivial problems. The phrase non-trivial problem, to me, the manager who, I'm working in a corporate environment, you know, the way I write software is I pick a release date and I work backwards to today and decide which features we cut.
Okay?
That's the managerial model for building software. And I would listen to these guys say non-trivial problem, and
your blood would run cold.
And I think, oh boy, there go three bullet points on my flyer.
So how come Kevin hadn't said non-trivial problem yet?
I think I've used the phrase in my comic strip. I think I've used the phrase non-trivial something or other before.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
But this time around, A, I'm not doing it with C, which means I don't have to spend all my time chasing memory allocation problems. And the second thing is, now we actually have demons, and we actually have sockets, and it's actually possible to write something like this. And
you don't
not hurt too bad.
You don't have to write the server software upon which this runs.
Yes, exactly.
You can write that. You can work up at this layer.
To make it worse, the first time I tried to make it work was on an ancient time-sharing system that ran on GE mainframes called Bart 3. That was so horrible that you should be deeply glad that you've never heard of it before and will never hear of it again. This thing didn't even have proper directories. It had 6-character monospace file names. There was a limited number in the directory, and I said the directory because you only got one per account.
Got one.
I spent, the good news is they had backported.
Must have water.
Yes.
Okay.
You water? Do I remember that line?
The good news is they had backported a C compiler onto this thing. The bad news is I spent about a third of my development time identifying and reporting C compiler bugs. As late as 89. I take it you know about this?
Well, he's a mainframe geek.
Yes.
Okay. You tell them how horrible Mark III was.
I have repressed, let's put it this way. My first computing experience was with Kronos on a CDC 6600. That is generally, yeah, uphill both ways on 110 bob over for a teletype. And that is, I had thought that was the most primitive interactive computing environment ever until I met Mark III.
Which was worse? Oh, God, it was horrible.
It speaks volumes that you can get an emulator to emulate OS 360. You can get an emulator to emulate various, you know, the 6600 and run Kronos on it. And you can't get an emulator to emulate Mark III on or this GE box.
You want to know how horrible this was? Programs, ordinary applications could not open files. Instead, you had to pre-create empty files for the applications to write into.
Yes.
With a special administrative tool.
Shriveling. Oh, man.
So what, are you going to computers or something?
Okay. But in fairness to those people in our audience who are not programmers, this probably should not descend into total techno-communication.
You know how the Mark III indicated memory?
It held memory, or excuse me, it held the pointer still and moved memory up and down. Sorry.
That probably would have been a more advanced approach than they actually used.
They held the pointer still, they held memory still, and then they rattled the box until the pointer moved.
That sounds more like it.
Go to sort.
Okay. I think we've descended deeply enough into the geek room.
Let's climb up now.
Into the geek room. So science fiction. I write science fiction, and science fact as illustrated in the technological advances of software in the last 10 years.
You're working really hard.
I'm trying
really
to find
hard,
something
Howard.
That we can talk about that, I mean,
okay.
Besides firearms.
Yeah. That actually does bring up an interesting topic, which is the influence of science fiction on the open source movement. The open source culture, as those of you who are occasionally part of it, probably.
Open source programmers in the room, anybody participating in the, get them up high. All right, everybody else, you need to thank these people.
For the fact that there's an internet to begin with.
Yeah. Influence on open source programming for science fiction. Speaking from experience,
yes.
I know that I have personally prevented software from shipping on time by result of programmers getting addicted to my comments. I have received emails from people who said, my deadline slipped because I spent 4 days in your archives.
But that made
me so happy.
Howard, you can console yourself with the fact that anybody who slipped their deadline because they spent 4 days reading your comic probably really needed a break.
Deadline would have slipped anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Deadline would have slipped anyway.
They were already burnt out.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things, I used to write science fiction short stories, and one of the ideas I had for, and this was back in, this was back when I was in college, I think it was around 1991, 92. I had this thought that something the size of this cordless telephone I had in my hand, like cordless telephones were cool. Okay, now forget cell phones. Something the size of this cordless telephone with a screen that was a computer, and then you'd have network, you'd access the network from like public points all over the place. I thought, boy, that would be cool. Now my story didn't make this happen. This was me just looking at what would seem logical. And what we've got today in this hotel is a system whereby you can get wireless access on something the size of a telephone.
Somebody pointed out a couple months ago in an essay there that the ubiquity of cell phones has done some interesting things to the writing of adventure fiction. Because you can no longer write plots in which people are cut off.
You remember the episode of Angel? You remember the episode of Angel where he doesn't use his cell phone?
He's trapped in a cooler.
Well, they've gotten him a cell phone. And they're like, dude, use your cell phone. And it was Joss Whedon recognizing, I can't write these perilous... These people would spend... They're friggin' demon hunters. They would spend $30 a month to be able to call for help.
Given the provider that doesn't have a lot of coverage.
Or locked in a freezer, it's surrounded by metal.
The point is, that's a marginal case, and it's going to get more marginal. There's a whole category of suspense plot that is about to go down the tubes.
One of my favorite episodes of The X-Files is a flashback episode where Mulder flashes back to 1993, I think it was, and he whips out his cell phone, and it's one of those Motorola bricks. Now, I carried one of those. I worked in tech support, and it was my knife in the barrel. You know, I had to have the cell phone. And I remember carrying this thing around and looking at it and thinking, boy, this is cool, and it's too big. I can't put it in my pocket. We call it the electronic leash, not because people could find me and yank my chain, but because it wouldn't fit anywhere. Yeah,
I sometimes forget this is in my pocket.
Yeah.
I couldn't find my cell phone the other day. It was in my back pocket. And I couldn't feel it within it.
Does anyone else here know the word ephemeralization? Buckminster Fuller predicted this back in the 60s. He said that
you had to walk too far for this.
Yeah, that was in the comics.
We saved firearms until you got back.
Oh, cool. So of course not.
Oh, what's your favorite caliber, Steve?
Oh, there's some really nice things.
What's the tab?
Oh, when you shoot
the 5.22. I'm still often fond of the 22 Colt Woodsman as my father. Was talking about 22. So,
12-gauge shotgun with target shot, only you score the edge of the shell with a razor blade so that the end of the shell comes off. We call these format slugs. And you shoot it at, what do you call these, a number 10 can of tomato sauce. Full of tomato sauce. I got yelled at because I pulled the trigger when one of the guys wasn't looking. Uh-huh. And because everybody wanted to see that. And yeah, you end up with a wad of plastic and metal about that big hitting the bucket and everything. So when I plank,
I'm partial to 1911 Patent 45 myself.
No, you laughed. Why did you laugh?
What?
Because I almost said that.
Separated after.
You're a man of taste.
But I think my favorite is still my dad's portion. It's old. It's only a 22, but it's more nicely made and more accurate than most of my dad's.
Boy, is it a sweet man.
Yeah. Recoil? What's that?
I mean, the designer, his name I can't remember, but he was nuts on the subject that it has to be possible to break the gun down with no tools. Did you not know that?
Yes.
That's the reason the firing pin is the way it is.
Damn it.
Yeah. Well, you get the firing pin out and you have a little screw down.
The firing pin is not going to get trouble.
Because he wasn't enough. If you replace it with something that's not a screwdriver, it might work better.
So the other thing we were talking about was the influence of science fiction on the open source movement.
Well, it's not something to
do. The predictive nature of science fiction and fiction in general. Steve and I were talking about this last night. The Illuminati New World Order card game has a card in it called Terrorist Nuke that has a picture of a pair of buildings with an explosion coming out of one of them. And people hollered at Steve.
I get mail about that. Mostly it's, how did you know? The answer, of course, is if you draw enough pictures of bad stuff, some of it will eventually, if you wait long enough, look like bad stuff that really happens.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and then there was the Pentagon with the explosion coming out of the center of it.
Yes, but then if you were going to draw a spooky picture of the Pentagon, what else could you draw?
If I were going to draw a spooky picture of the Pentagon, I would take a picture of the Pentagon, obviously recognizable, and then a satellite photo, and then with...
Photoshop in a big pentagram?
Photoshop in a pentagram.
God, our minds are all warped in the exact same way.
And have some sort of, you know, ghastly apparition photoshopped behind the line drawing, bulging the lines out. If I were going to be something like
that. Sounds like you've already been.
No, it sounds like you should.
Let's see, well, Google Earth can get me a good picture of Pentagon.
Maybe.
Oh, if I go looking on Google Earth for pictures of Pentagon, what's the worst thing that could happen?
Cybernetic death ninja is coming down your chimney.
Ninja Burger hires out. This is starting to sound like the Illuminati game we played. Oh.
Okay.
There's a piece of crossover right there.
Yes, he thought it was a good card last night. First time he played Illuminati, and he came up with a valid card. How many people here have played Illuminati?
Well, that's fine.
Okay, that's enough to make it worthwhile.
Okay. Well, we're playing Illuminati, and of course the object of the game is to capture other groups so that you, the UFOs or the gnomes in Zurich, control the South American Nazis and Allmart. And well, one of the cards was MicroStuff, okay, a big software company. And I looked at that and I thought, oh, you got a software company. I tried to capture it and I got blocked. And I was feeling bitter. But why? These people were playing like they wanted to win. And I just wanted to have fun, honest. And so they blocked me, and in typical sour grapes mode, I said, you know what? I spent the last year not working in the software industry. The last thing I want to do is own MicroStuff. Thank you for not having me do that. And Steve mentioned, well, somewhere in the deck there's this new one called Big Blue Stream. It's another software company. And I thought, oh, so we've got Microsoft and IBM represented. What about the open source movement? And Steve said, no, we don't have that, but that would make a good card. Blank card, and I start scribbling, and what we came up with was Open GNUnix. And Open GNUnix is the polar opposite of MicroStuff, which means their alignment.
Now you don't have to give MicroStuff.
MicroStuff's alignment is conservative, straight, criminal. Okay? Conservative, straight, criminal. Open GNUnix is liberal, weird, fanatic. And yeah, we looked at that and we thought, you know.
Tell them about the graphic.
Oh, yeah, the graphic. Yeah. I drew this, I needed a picture, and so I took a GNU head and put it on the little cute little penguin body. So there's something on that card to offend everybody from Richard Stallman to whoever the polar opposite within the open source community.
That needs to be a wobbly-headed doll.
Well, there are a fair number of people who would say it's me, and I'm not offended. But then, unlike certain other community leaders, I have a sense of humor.
Well, when you talk about communities, one of the worst communities to be a member of and to try to participate in is the community of web card units. Is Scott Martin here? Scott Kellogg? Am I the only web card unit in the room? Let's go!